This evening what we're going to be covering is suicide and euthanasia. And I want to start with a quotation from Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 23. It's a simple text. I know, O Lord, that man's life is not his own. I know, O Lord, that man's life is not his own. This is a foundational tenet of the Christian world and life view. And its view of the sanctity come sacredness of life. Life is not something that springs from a nothingness and which therefore we can make our own deliberations about and evaluations on. Life comes from an author, from a creator, from a governor, from a judge. Life comes from God. And life is lived in the midst of a fallen world. What Paul calls in Galatians 1, this present evil world. We should be under no kind of inhibitions or no illusion about the fact that this world is fallen. I remember an interview that was given with Francis Schaeffer towards the end of his life. I think it's still on the end of his film, How Should We Then Live? And this interview was given by his son, who unfortunately has shown that he never actually was one who embraced the faith. But his son is asking him, are you angry with God that in the midst of this work you have this brain cancer which is claiming your life? Schaeffer's answer was, I suppose, what you would expect from a man of God. He said, no, because I take the fall seriously. I take the fall seriously. Now, of course, what he's saying there is he's not talking abstractly. He's not talking in a theoretical sense. He's talking in a real, concrete sense. He takes the fall seriously as something that impinges on his life and threatens it and hurts it and that would take it from him. In other words, although he taught a Christian worldview, he also lived the Christian worldview. He thought the Christian worldview. And fundamental to our understanding of any issue, moral or even abstract issues out there in the world, is the Christian foundation of the fact that we are created by God, that we're fallen, but we're still valuable because we're created in the image of God. God is not an absentee landlord. God is not doing his own thing now. God is present with us, interested in us, thinks about us, and wants us to turn to him and embrace what we should have never forsaken, which is our absolute dependence upon him for all things in this fallen world. So when we come to suicide and euthanasia, with all of the different avenues that we can go down and all of the different arguments that have been brought up, we start from that position. Starting from that position, therefore, we can straight away go forward and we can start to block off certain arguments, in fact, quite a few of the arguments, those arguments particularly which say that it is the individual's right to die in the way that they choose. The Christian can never go down that road because the Christian fundamentally disagrees with that view. The Christian says, no, life is a gift. It is not a right. And because God is the author of life and God takes life because of the doctrine of providence and his ruling in this world, we can never start our arguments, or even include in our arguments, this idea of, well, it's mine to do with what I want. It's at my disposal. That is, whether I die or not. That is not even a consideration for the Christian. Now, we understand, because this is a fallen world, because there are such things as mental diseases. I'm not like some of the counselors that believe there's no such thing as mental disease. There is such a thing as mental disease. Of course there is. Now, it's not as prevalent as the world says it is, but it's there. You can have diseases of the body, you can have diseases of the mind. The mind, as far as it is connected to the brain, can be affected by a diseased brain. When the mind is affected because of some kind of disorder, then a person who is suicidal because of that is not to be considered as somebody who is just depressed, or somebody who is in the wrong state of mind, or somebody who just commits suicide for honor's sake, or just as a philosophical statement. One thinks of Camus and philosophers like that who committed suicide because of that. Now, you see, there are two different aspects to suicide, and what we're talking about here is the person who, quote-unquote, is in their right mind, not a person who is unfortunately not in their right mind and who commits suicide. They're irrational, and therefore, if they were in the right mind, they would not have done the irrational thing. Do you see that? Now, however, we may be able to, with proper counseling and so on, make the person who is thinking irrationally start to think rationally by pointing them to the foundation of the biblical worldview for the value of life and thinking God's thoughts after him about their life in order to change the irrationality that they have succumbed to. But that, I don't think, is always possible, unfortunately. You can disagree with me on that one. But I don't believe that's always possible. Sometimes Paul and I and others, we go to Trinity Mission, we talk to some old people who obviously are, using the colloquialism, not all there. Even using childlike language with them, it doesn't get through. The reason that we're trying to communicate with them is not interpreted that way by them. So suicide in those issues and those circumstances is not what I'm talking about. I want to concentrate on suicide of somebody who is able to make decisions, able to know right from wrong, okay? That's all I have time for today. The other issues, that's something you'll have to read up on, but I think I've given you a general view there. Well, when it comes to this issue of suicide, then obviously, again, the world has its view, and the Christian, if he is in the Bible and thinking biblically, has his or her view. And you say, well, you keep saying that. Every time you get up here, you keep saying, well, the world sees things one way and Christians are supposed to see things another way. And sometimes the world sees things the Christian way, but again, you get up here and you say that although he appears to see things the same way as a Christian, that's only a superficial view. It's really not based upon the existence of the God who is there, and the Christ who has come into the world, who gives value to life by his death on the cross. No, it's not. And it's most important that we always underline that fact. There is an independent or unique Christian view which is based on our faith in the Word of God. And we operate within that sphere. We don't operate in an autonomous sphere, an independent sphere, a sphere where it's okay to step outside of what God says and make our own decisions, our own deliberations. That's sin. Whatsoever is not of faith is sin, the Bible says. Let me quote here an instance of a person who committed suicide in 1995. This was something that was in the New York Times on the 6th of July 1995. It's reprinted in Mylander's book Bioethics. A man named George Delury helped his wife of 22 years, Myrna Lebov, to commit suicide. Miss Lebov was suffering from multiple sclerosis and near the end of her life was able only to wash her face and hands, feed herself if the food had already been cut, apply her makeup and brush her teeth. In addition, her memory had begun to be affected. When she asked her husband if he would help her to end her life, he reports that, quote, I said of course I'd help. I also said in effect that I was astonished she'd fought so hard and so long to keep going. I would have quit a lot sooner, end quote. He learned that one of the medications his wife was taking could prove fatal if taken in a sufficiently large dose. So over several months, she cut back on her dosage, saving enough of the medicine to kill herself. Then on Independence Day, they shared the traditional celebrative meal of chicken and wine, and he diluted the pills to provide a drinkable mixture. She drank it and was dead the next morning. Quote, the primary project of her life was to be independent, end quote, Mr. Delury said, and so she exercised that independence one last time on July the 4th. He, for his part, hopes to write a book about death and especially about what he calls the considerate hero, an elderly person, for example, quote, who, facing serious illness, says this money would be better spent elsewhere. End quote. Now here we have an illustration of a person who asks help from her husband to commit suicide. She herself is taking the dose. She's committing suicide. He's just helping her to do it because she is not physically able to do what is necessary over that period of time. And the reason for this is obviously, first of all, that the quality of her life is not that which she would want it to be. And therefore, she doesn't think life worth living with multiple sclerosis eating its way, working its way into her life and into her very mind. And because of that, she believes she has a right to take her own life. And as her husband said, one of the cardinal things in her life was to be independent. And this, therefore, is the kind of the crowning achievement of this suicide and of her life, was that they celebrated her death on Independence Day. There are some interesting side avenues we can go down there with in relation to the whole idea of American independence and the Declaration of Independence, which some people, unfortunately, over here, even Christians, believe is a Christian document. It certainly is not a Christian document. It is an Enlightenment document. It is a document that takes liberties with the biblical God and says that God has given man rights of particular independence. Well, these rights have to be subsumed under a biblical theological view if they are going to be properly interpreted. Remember that the author of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson, was no Christian. We have this story and we can feel sorry for her, can't we? We can feel sorry for this lady. Absolutely we can. We can feel sympathy for this lady. But the moral question is pointed up. Does she have the right, or did she have the right, and did her husband have the right to take her life? Because certainly he was party to it, wasn't he? And the Christian must consider this from the biblical viewpoint. And he starts with God. He never starts with the individual. Now, she started with the individual, but she doesn't have God. She has herself. She has her loved one. Now, because she has herself and her loved one, we must first of all say that she is missing a key ingredient which is needed in order for her decision-making to be correct and moral. She's missing God. She's missing the author of life. And because of that, she's seeing the picture askew. And if she sees the picture askew, then her moral decision-making, as well as her other decision-making, is also going to be askew. Do you see that? And therefore, what she values and the basis upon which she makes her ethical decision and then conducts herself in light of that is all wrong. It's fallen. Godless. And therefore, she commits suicide in the teeth of the reality of God that he has placed in the world and in her life. And so, the Christian, therefore, although he feels sorry and sympathy, he says that there is something absolutely wrong with this kind of thinking, which starts from the right to death, because life is a gift. Let's turn in our Bibles to, first of all, Mark chapter 12, verses 28 to 33. And there we read, Mark chapter 12, 28. Then one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning, together perceiving that he had answered them well, asked him, which is the first commandment of all? Jesus answered him, the first of all the commandments is, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. This is the first commandment. And the second, like it, is this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. Now, first of all, I want you to notice that in these two great commandments, the numerical order is important. It's very important. Now, we can say the numerical order of the Ten Commandments is important, but after we get the first three, it's perhaps not as important. And we see in the book of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy 5, for example, that some of the later commandments are different than they are in Exodus 20, in a different order. And so those orders, at least for some of the commandments, aren't as vital. But you see here, the order is crucial. If you put the second commandment of loving our neighbor above ourselves first, then you have theological liberalism. You have the social gospel. And you have, again, man asserting his right, which he doesn't have, to deliberate without God. And so the first commandment, which is the biblical order, must be primary. The first commandment is the first. Because the first commandment is the basis for the second commandment. The first commandment is the way that we are to be toward our Creator. And that is the basis for the way that we are to be towards ourselves and towards others. Now turn to Matthew chapter 5 in the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter 5. Look first of all at verse 21 and 22. You have heard that it was said to those of old, "You shall not murder. And whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, 'Raca,' shall be in danger of the council. Whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be in danger of hell fire." Now, I'm not going to go into an exposition of this text, but Raca was a term of abuse. It was a pejorative term. It was a looking down your nose term of "you worthless person." And the idea of fool here, well, the Bible calls people fools, doesn't it? The fool has said in his heart, "There is no God." Okay, "You fools and blind," Jesus called the Pharisees in Matthew 23. Well, the way the word "fool" is being used here is not that way. In those instances, like the fool in the book of Proverbs, that's an identification. It's just an identification. Somebody is acting foolishly, in folly, and so the label sticks. But here, the idea is that it is a denunciation of a person's character, and it is an evaluation of their worth. And therefore, you see, Jesus says they're in danger of hell fire for that kind of a judgment. Why? Why is that important? Why is this relevant? Well, can you not see that what Jesus is doing here is that he's saying life is so valuable, human life is so sacred, that the wrong evaluation of another person is a terrible sin. And the valuation that we put on life must be a very carefully thought out valuation and must be in accord with God's valuation. Now, when we do that, we put the argument back into the lap of God and we cannot anymore speak of our rights. Again, in verses 43 to 47, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy.'" Now, this is not said in the Old Testament, but this is the Midrash. This is the way that the Jewish scribes were interpreting it. "But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you." This is the great Christian ethic here. Love your enemies. "That you may be sons of your Father in heaven. You may be like God," you see, like this. "For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good and sends rain on the just and the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Do not the tax collectors do so? Therefore, you shall be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect." And that means having the correct valuation of what the Father has made human life. God is the author of life, and therefore the right of life and death lies with him and with him alone. Bringing this into the ethical sphere, we must say that the right to choose death actively, to kill oneself, and I mean it in those terms, to kill oneself, or to ask somebody else to help you to kill yourself, is an avenue that is forbidden for the creature on the biblical basis. Because of the dignity of human life, because man is made in the image of God, because God's providence is over all, and because these things are so important. You know, it is important also that we understand that in the Christian viewpoint, death is an evil, but it isn't the last evil. It isn't the worst evil. The worst evil is what may come after death, and that must enter into our decision making too. In a sense, we can see life as a, if you will allow me to use the word, a probation here on earth. Because what we are like in this world and how we live our life responsibly before God or irresponsibly before God shall have an effect in the way that we are after this life and into eternity. This is very important, I think. And so, just on this issue, therefore, of suicide, we go back to Jeremiah 10. Lord, man's life is not his own. And people say, well, what about Samson? Didn't Samson commit suicide? No, Samson did not commit suicide. You see, because Samson made a decision to overthrow the Philistines. This was an act of war, if you like. And he made a decision to overthrow the Philistine leaders. Now, this meant that probably his life would be forfeit. But he wasn't actively there out to kill himself. His thoughts were to destroy the Philistine. And in the same way, a soldier who goes over the top and goes perhaps into certain death toward the enemy, he's not actually wanting to kill himself, although he may very well end up forfeiting his life. But you see, he doesn't go over there saying, well, I'm going to commit suicide. I'm just going to give my life away. He goes there for another reason. And that other reason is most important. You see, if the other reason may involve us forfeiting our lives, then that is not suicide, that is not euthanasia, that is not despising the gift of God, you see. And so a martyr who stands up for the truth of Jesus Christ and goes to the flames is not committing suicide. A person who witnesses to Jesus Christ and will not deny him and has his throat cut because of it is not committing suicide, because that is not what is in his mind. Whether he lives or dies, that is in the hands of a greater power than himself. But if we are saying, no, it is my deliberation, it is my decision, and I'm going to end my life, I'm going to kill myself, or I'm going to ask you to help me to kill myself, then you see, that is going beyond the bounds. We cannot do that. And so suicide, and as we're going to see, euthanasia, is something that is disallowed by the very teaching of the Bible. Let me just give you a quote here from John Jefferson Davis's Evangelical Ethics. He says, from the perspective of Judeo-Christian tradition, euthanasia violates the commandment, you shall not murder, in Exodus 20, verse 13. The taking of human life for whatever motives is strictly forbidden in Scripture, except in those very narrowly defined circumstances, such as justifiable war, self-defense, and capital punishment. And then he says, societies that have gone beyond these narrow exceptions have opened the door to unintended but tragic levels of bloodshed and violence. And he says further on, the euthanasia mentality sees man as the lord of his own life. The Christian sees human life as a gift from God, to be held in trusteeship throughout man's life on earth. You are not your own. You were bought with a price. So glorify God in your body, 1 Corinthians 6:19 to 20. Determining the moment of death, Davis adds, is God's prerogative, not man's, quoting Job 14:5. And so we have to, I think, be very clear on where the Christian truth leads us in this issue. And for a Christian friend who is struggling with depression and with the crush of their circumstances, we first of all must affirm to them the fact that their life is not their own. It's a gift from God. It's answerable to God. Secondly, their circumstances, however bad, are under the gaze of God. And then thirdly, as Christians, we have a responsibility to help. We have a responsibility to help. You see, the whole argument of Christian ethics is that it is not us that stand alone. It is not about a person suffering alone. or a person rejoicing alone, or a person even making a decision alone. Truly, it is about the church as a family, as a community in whom God, the Holy Spirit, is working, that cares, that comforts, that is there, or that rejoices with those that rejoice, or advises, or prays for the person making a life-changing decision. And if a church doesn't do that, it's not a church. It's not functioning as a church. It's not doing anything but playing church. You must understand, you see, that when it comes down to these big issues, you see, if the church has not been functioning correctly, it won't function correctly in that situation either. And that is a tragic legacy that that church leaves. Now let me again turn for help here to Mylander's book, where he speaks here about the Christian ethicist Paul Ramsey, who spoke about the Christian approach to suffering, dealing with suffering. Because, of course, when it comes to euthanasia, what about this issue of people who are just going through so much difficulty, so much pain, or their quality of life is so bad, as we estimate it, that we think, well, they have a right, a decision to make about whether they should prolong their life or not. Now, I've already started to address the crucial question. And the crucial question is not whether refusing treatment that would just prolong life but not cure is a necessary evil. I'm talking about whether we seek to end our lives in an active sense. Do you see that? There is a difference. And one, you're refusing treatment because maybe the treatment is a burden, or maybe that, as in the case of, for example, Martin Lloyd-Jones. Martin Lloyd-Jones, at the end of his life, refused treatment. He says, let me go to be with the Lord. Was he sinning? No, he was dying. He was on the way to his Lord. He just didn't want his life prolonged here any longer. He didn't say, well, give me a cocktail of something so I can get to be with the Lord quicker. That wasn't his thinking at all. It is, no, there's no reason to prolong my life any further. Death is just around the corner. But here with euthanasia, we're dealing with this choice to end life. It's this Promethean idea of autonomy and independence instead of dependence upon God. And so, again, in the book Bioethics, Mylander here speaks about what Paul Ramsey has to say, and I think this is worth reading out. If my life is not simply my possession to dispose of as I see fit, as if the God relation did not exist, the same is true of the lives of others. I have no authority to act as if I exercise lordship over another's life, and another has no authority to make me lord over his life and death. Hence, Christians should not request or cooperate in either assisted suicide or euthanasia. Do you see the argument there? Depends on the fact that God is there. In a chapter written a quarter century ago that remains to this day a classic discussion of the issues, Paul Ramsey sought to articulate an ethic of, quote, only caring for the dying, unquote. Such an ethic, he suggested, would reject two opposite extremes, refusing to acknowledge death by continuing the struggle against it when that struggle is useless, or aiming to hasten the coming of death. Do you see that? In other words, there is this refusal to accept that your loved one is dying and just want to prolong life any old way. He said that is not care, or helping the person die. That's not care either. Neither of those things really is within the Christian ethic and within the Christian prerogative. Now let me continue here. Neither of these can count as care for one of our fellow human beings. Each is a form of abandonment. We should always try to care for the dying person, but we should only care. To try to do more by seizing either of the extremes is always to give something other or less than care. He says, why might we be tempted to ask for or to offer euthanasia? One of the reasons has already been suggested in the discussion of suicide, our commitment to autonomy or self-determination. I am tempted to believe that my life is my own to do with as I please, and tempted to believe that another's life is her own to do with as she pleases. A second reason, equally powerful and tempting, is our desire to bring relief to those who suffer greatly. The argument for euthanasia rests chiefly on these two points, either taken singly or together. And then he continues here. If self-determination is truly so significant that we have a right to help in ending our life, then how can we insist that such help can rightly be offered only to those who are suffering greatly? Others who are not suffering may still find life meaningless. Think of many students today who are committing suicide or doing the next best thing with their lives, drugs, alcohol, so on. Just this nihilism that there is with young people today. Others who are not suffering may still find life meaningless, the game not worth the candle. They too are autonomous, and if autonomy is as important as the argument claims it is, then their autonomous request for euthanasia should also be honored, even if they are not suffering greatly. Similarly, if the suffering of others makes so powerful a claim upon us that we should kill them to bring it to an end, it is hard to believe that we ought to restrict such merciful relief only to those who are self-determining, who are competent to request it. Surely fully autonomous people are not the only human beings who can suffer greatly. Thus, from both directions, from each prong of the argument, there will be pressure to expand the class of candidates for euthanasia. This is what's happened in Holland, by the way, where euthanasia is legal. What has happened over there is that thousands of old people have been put to death, have been killed, mainly on the request of their offspring. Brings the Terry Schiavo case before us, doesn't it? There, you see, the courts, having thrown out the Ten Commandments and so on, the courts decided that the husband had the right to terminate this person's life. Even though there were doubts, there was some circumstantial evidence that wasn't quite right and fitting, even though there was an alternative of care that was offered, the judge took the decision to kill her. That was an unethical decision. Why was it an unethical decision? He didn't have that right. Not if care was offered. Not if there was a pretty good argument on the other side. Do you see that? From a Christian perspective, that is key. Now, here it is. John Stott, in his book New Issues Facing Christians Today, says this on page 376 in talking about euthanasia. He says this is popularly called mercy killing and is divided between voluntary euthanasia, assisted suicide, the death occurring at the explicit plea of the patient, or involuntary euthanasia, the death occurring by someone else's decision when the patient is incapable of giving consent. It is essential to clarify that euthanasia, whether voluntary or involuntary, is intentional killing. Do you see that? And I hope that you can see that means that that Christian cannot go down that road, because that's not his prerogative. Now, I do understand, what about a person who's in a vegetative state and they're kept on for months and months? I understand about that. But a Christian says that that person does not have a right to, or the doctor does not have a right to terminate life, to kill. This means, of course, that decisions have to be made earlier when the person is brought in, perhaps. And sometimes it may mean that the person's life, until there can be a proper ethical decision made on some basis, for example, if treatment is being given, I'm not talking about food, I'm talking about if treatment is being given, medication is being given. We might say that if the medication is not given, or if the medication is increased so to improve the quality, maybe to lessen the pain or whatever, then that is not an abuse, even though it may hasten death. Do you see that? Why? Because care is involved in that, not killing. And I don't have time, of course, to go into that right now. Let me finish off with a quote from Mylander again on this issue of the refusal of treatment. I wish I had more time to go into the instance that we've just spoken about. But he says this, a mathematical precision here is not possible. You're not going to be 100% on this, but your decision-making processes need to be in this league. First, a treatment may be refused if it is useless. Usefulness is, of course, relative to the patient's condition. Many treatments may be helpful, even life-saving, for some patients, but of little use to others. Moreover, a treatment once helpful might cease to be when the patient's disease has progressed to a new stage. This criterion is especially important when a person is in the last stages of dying. We should note, however, that to be irretrievably dying is not the same as to be terminally ill. One can be terminally ill and still be expected to live for months or even years. For the patient who is irretrievably dying, few, if any, treatments can really be useful. Continued attempts to cure such a patient only impose needlessly and may well get into the way of the effort to care for this person as best we can. Now, of course, you have to deal with the individual cases. I understand that. And he says, there is a second reason, in addition to uselessness, on the basis of which treatments may be rightly refused. Treatments that are useful and perhaps even life-saving may sometimes be excessively burdensome. Because life is not our God, we need not accept all burdens, no matter how great, in order to stay alive. Again, the person is dying. This is not the fact that they are going to die. This is not the same, as he said, of having a terminal disease. They are actually in the stages of dying here. And he says, we need to recognize clearly what this means. It means that we might rightly refuse even useful treatment that would prolong our life for a significant period of time if that treatment really does carry with it significant burdens. I'm dying, let me go to be with the Lord. That's not sin, that's not suicide, that's not euthanasia. It's just allowing, quote-unquote, nature to take its course. We're out of time here, but I wish I could have dealt with the Terry Schiavo issue more. And, of course, there are books and things on the website that deal with that more. And so I invite you to read those and study those. But just to say, the key thing on these issues of suicide and euthanasia is that life is a gift and it's not ours to take. It is God's. Let's pray, shall we?